Marsh from Soccer here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, as you know, we took a bit of a break towards the end of the season. That led to a huge buildup of realignment Q&As that we get from our Supercast subscribers. So I thought it'd be a great idea today to actually just answer a bunch of them before we get way too many to answer later in the month. Quick reminder about how this works. If you subscribe and support The Realignment at realignment.supercast.com, you not only get additional bonus questions and bonus content, but you actually get to submit said questions on our Realignment Supercast platform. So everything that we're answering today, including the free previews, are brought to you by people who subscribe to our Supercast and have gotten all of this other great stuff. So once again, if you'd like to get access to this full Q&A conversation and submit Q&As of your own, go to realignment.supercast.com. Sagar, can you just throw them a quick bit about why, you know, supporting us is important, but also just the independence, building things into something serious, all those great things.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's vital, especially, you know, middle of a recession, all that stuff. We need independent cash flow that's outside of everything. But beyond that, it costs money. Also, I did somebody saying like, bro, Sagar saying it costs money and we're broadcasting in 1080p. That's the whole point. By the way, you guys want to know how much 4K camera costs? Go ahead and look it up because I had to do it over at Breaking Points and I almost killed myself when I saw the bill. So I just want people to know how exactly expensive it gets and if we do actually want to up our production value. So that's only reason enough as to why you should go ahead and subscribe.
And the funny take here is I saw that comment too and it made me laugh. Yeah. And I think it's helpful to clarify something. If all this was about when it came to monetization was upping to a DSLR camera for both of us, that could have been done eons ago, and frankly, it doesn't even require supporters. The real thing that we're spending money on right now is just staff time, right? We're producing 3 to 4 episodes a week. There's production, there's editing, that frankly is even, I think, a level more important than it comes from the, you know, basic stuff like the camera. So the way I'm thinking about this is I want us to bring in enough money to the point where we can just run this show completely independently. And then once you've gotten to that next step, which we're actually about, we're almost like hitting that point now. So I'm very excited for support. But then that next step, of course, is, hey, we've got all of our basics covered for the next fiscal year. Let's upgrade the camera. Yeah, right. Let's do dynamic things, all those different bits. Let's get into the first few preview questions, and then we'll get into the locked ones. Really liked this question. I'm curious what you think, Sagar. Question one, is this a binary moment? During the latest chat with the always delightful Frank DiStefano, Marshall stated he thinks that we're in a binary moment and there's no evading those options and therefore the attendant alienation of voters when you do so. How much of the landscape of current and potential political issues does that cover? It seems like we hear about a particular range of issues, even assuming all are truly important, that have easy binary divisions because of the incentives of media and politics. That doesn't mean there aren't additional solutions which haven't bubbled up yet. What would you predict as being new issues emerging into politics, such as around technologies like VR, genetic engineering, AI, and cybernetics, that will mix things up and create new binaries in the coming years? What do you think, Sagar?
Yeah, I mean, actually now is the perfect time to ask that. I think you could have made a case, and I would have argued against it, that we're not in a binary moment before the Trump FBI raid. But the moment that it happened and Glenn Youngkin was coming out and denouncing it, you're still living in the Trump age. And I just think a lot of people don't want to grapple with that. Like, the Trump age began in 2011. If anything, Mitt Romney was just an afterthought. The day that birtherism kind of hit the stage, the day that Trump, frankly, got his regular spot by Roger Ailes on Fox and Friends, we entered the Trump age. And the Trump age will be over when he's dead. And I just think that there's just really no way, even if he doesn't become the next president, he will still be the driving force of the GOP. So just deal with it. And, you know, I personally have dealt with it. It's very simple. I'm like, okay, the GOP is Trump. And I'm like, I don't like Trump. So then I'm just not going to be affiliated with it. But a lot of people are trying to cope. They're like, well, I still am mad about inflation. And it's like, yeah, but it doesn't matter. Like, that doesn't mean anything. And yeah, so that's just really my easy response to that question.
Yeah, and that's what I'm really getting at. People don't like the binary moment take, and they don't like it because the implications just suck. Right, like, Sagar, think of everything you just said, which I agree with analytically. This is going to go on until Trump is actually just either on his deathbed or just actually retired, completely just retired for whatever reason. The implications of that for like the next 10 years are not great. They're not fun. I do think, though, one has to just reckon with that. To the question about new issues like VR, genetic engineering, AI, cybernetics, could those create new binaries? Yeah, definitely. I think there could be some point in the future where those sort of issues really force very polarizing choices that folks are going to have to decide around, but they just aren't there now. No one is voting on AI. No one is voting on VR, aside from whether or not people are even buying VR products in the first place. Genetic engineering, that could be interesting. So you could see there being a world where, let's say, some sort of biological incident happens. There is some type of food, nutritional issue. That could cause something. But up until now, those just aren't new binaries. And I think that my pushback to Frank a little bit is, you know, now that he's not on the episode, is just sort of that I think he uses the prospect of those future issues as being issues the two-party system can't really handle as basically an excuse for why that system will break down. When everything that's happened the past 2 years, Sagar, has convinced me that whenever VR, genetic engineering, AI, and cybernetics do become, if they do become, big binary issues, the two-party system will adapt. There's, you know, those issues, I think, will fit into like very polarizing places, and people will go one place and they will go another place. The one other thing I'll just close on this one is the questioner basically referred to this as binary divisions are emerging because of media incentives and political incentives. I'm not quite sure I think that's true. I just think there are just certain issues that, due to the nature of them and due to the way that they sit on the hierarchy of like things we think we need to engage with, are just going to be high up there. So once again, abortion, that's not CNN turning that into a polarizing issue. There actually is just this question of like, did the Roe v. Wade settlement work, or should we be building something new? And should that happen via the federal government, via the judiciary, or should it happen at the state level? Another binary could emerge if Republicans win everything in 2024 and try to pass a national bill. But once again, even in that debate, that will be binary, not because of the media, but because the debate will be, should the post-war world be set by the national level or set at the local level? So that's a good way to think of that one. Mm-hmm. Next question that has to do with something that is very up on Sagar's thing. Vibes versus policy. Enjoying your elevation of, quote, vibes into the political lexicon, but not totally sure I understand all the analysis or how you're using it. For instance, you take issue with the Forward Party platform being coded center-left, but isn't the reality that most of Yang's appeal as a persona is much about vibes than it is about also the fact that, but isn't it the reality that most of Yang's appeal as a persona is much about vibes that in some sense also cater to those on the center right? If vibes are the key driver of politics at the moment, doesn't your critique of policy here ignore the synthesis of policies as vibes that might work with Yang as a third party as opposed to Yang as a Democrat? I see Yang's selected policies as an attempt to cast a broad net while maintaining some sort of policy specificity and centrist vibes, not left, not right, but forward. Maybe this doesn't help him pick up any cultural momentum or seem relevant right now, but it seems like a decent strategy to grow a party in the long term if you can make it relevant. The more generic question, if you want to get right to it, can you articulate how you view the relationship between vibes and policy? What levers to pull to be effective? Why do you think one plays a greater role over the other in driving the realignment? Sincerely, Joe and Dan.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think people maybe misunderstood that. When I was saying that whenever I said it's a coded center left, that's actually, I meant the vibe of it, which is that I just don't think that the quote unquote vibe of the Forward Party is just going to excite anybody who would otherwise support, maybe not even Donald Trump, but even support a Republican. I just think that fundamentally misunderstands the discontent and the reason that people vote Republican in the first place, which is almost 100% driven by grievance. And unless you can really get to that, then I don't really think you're going to have any crossover whatsoever.
Yeah, that's a good answer too, Sagar, because A, it's not just that. If you actually look at the ideas that Yang put out, like in his 2018 book, if you look at the ideas in the Forward Party book, and then if you just look at what basically bubbles up whenever Forward Party people talk, it's all just center left. Center left to left. The issues of political reform right now just are not right wing. You do not have right wing people talking about. There's definitely a world where, actually, no. So to the point of Nick Seabrook on the gerrymandering episode, back in the 70s and 80s, gerrymandering, if you're talking about a house that was controlled by Democrats for 40 years, would have been an issue that would resonate with the right. Because gerrymandering in the country at the time led to a situation where, I mean, it's kind of crazy to talk about, like, Democrats straight up controlled the House for 40 years. So that issue put Andrew Yang in the 80s. He was talking about gerrymandering. That definitely would have had a right vibe. But now that issue has a left vibe, especially because Republicans control state legislatures. They're probably going to take back the House, all those different bits there. Moving to your point, too, with the vibe, like, once again, I would just really stress that someone just realize, and actually someone kind of like pointed this out in the pushback to the Washington Post article that the Forward Party people put out. Most of their examples of like the left being out of control were some Democrats want to abolish the Second Amendment. And obviously you could quibble with the debating point about whether or not like most Democrats want to actually do that. But like, let's just take that as a given. Like EOD, like that language is sort of like a pitch for the party. Like that's for centrist voters. That just goes to Sagar's point of like, none of that is basically like searching for that. So yeah, I would also just say, frankly, like the whole vibe, the question that was asked here was like, what's the difference between vibes and policy? And honestly, it's just kind of a mix. It's kind of a mix. And sometimes policy could be vibes and vibes could be policy. But here's what we're really just describing when we say it. Like, we're really just talking about our intuition. It's the quote about pornography. You know it when you see it. And Sagar and I, as people who have done this professionally for actually a decent amount of time, I can look at a candidacy and I can look at a party and I could say, oh yeah, like this guy, this gal, this institution has its finger on the pulse of the country right now. And I'm sorry, I like Andrew, but Forward and him do not have that.
I will say, actually, Andrew did the one thing that had nothing to do with the Forward Party, which actually probably would translate to some, not even Republican support, but actually is getting to it, when he was like, yeah, I really hope the FBI really has something, because if not, this would lead to a lot of persecution complex by the right. And I was like, oh, by the way, he was viciously attacked for that. But that was a correct insight. And I was like, that actually does get far more to the heart of what he should be talking about, if that makes sense.
Well, no, that makes a lot of sense. That's a great point. Yeah. Because here's the other problem with what you're describing, too. That forced him to make a binary. That was a binary response to a moment. And at worst, I think Forward Party folks like to act as if it's possible to just rise above everything and not make statements. Andrew Yang, you know, that's actually a really good point, Sagar. Andrew Yang taking a position, which I suspect a secret number of people to the left hold, plenty of people in the center hold, and lots of right people hold, would feel that. But once again, like, that's not a amorphous, like, oh, like, why can't we all just like get along and vibe, and it's all the media's fault and it's all the two party system's fault. No, like, he took a binary stand. So that's a good way to think about this. Okay, so this is the last of our open questions for folks. This question is Zihan right about globalization? Peter Zihan episodes always do very well, so we will answer this one in the public section. Which of Zihan's predictions about the future of globalization do you think are likely, just plausible, or downright unlikely? He also assumes that significant U.S. political change or reform is unlikely, and you said you don't think it's possible in this climate. What do you think about the need to change or reform to be possible, and is there anything the average voter can do to encourage that? How bullish are you on the 20-year trajectory of the U.S.?
I don't know. I go back and forth every day. I could give both cases. I could give you the Zihan case and I could give you the US case. I'm probably more sympathetic to the Zihan case. I just think that the level of distraction that we currently have going on at our top political system is just leading to all sorts of insane downstream effects, which just like globalization of the, for example, I mean, the mid-2000s, none of us were really arguing about trade. It was just happening. Like there was a bipartisan consensus. Hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs were leaving. We didn't really think about it at all. We only thought about it whenever it became a problem. I see these signs everywhere. It just happened this morning, Marshall. 20% of the U.S. aluminum market is likely to go offline because the plant simply can't afford to run because they don't because energy prices are too high. No one's going to notice that until it becomes like a discrete shortage. But I'm looking at that. I'm like, oh, this is a serious problem. And if you consider energy problems that we have right now, the quibbling, the fact is, actually, I saw a very interesting piece today that China, for the first time, actually overtook the United States in citations of quality and quantity of scientific research. This is an academic thing, as in that for the first time in the history of the United States or modern history of the United States, we've actually been overtaken by another nation in terms of the quality and the quantity of scientific literature that's being published in the academic sphere. That has a whole host of issues in terms of research dollars, in terms of actual innovation and how much stuff is downstream from those. And I just don't think we're going to pay attention to that until currently the number is like 26, 24. We're not going to pay attention until it's like 50, 25. And so that is why I'm probably more sympathetic to the Zihan case. I'm not saying that the US is not strong and isn't resilient and doesn't have many proven ability in order to pull itself out of a hole, but like I am saying, we're going to have to pull ourselves out of a hole, and this is very unpleasant. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'll go down the list here. So number one would be, I think that Peter is right at a framing level, and he's been consistently right at a framing level. You know, if you're thinking about absent superpower from 2017, talking about how like energy and independence and America stepping back from its role on the global stage, like that was the great narrative for understanding the Trump years, 2020 disunited nations, you know, like a world that's further breaking down of the world order. Every single narrative that comes out of those next 2 years fits within that. That fits into a world where no one basically trusts the WHO anymore. That fits into a world where no one thinks the Ukraine war or the Taiwan crisis are going to be resolved on the floor of the UN. Those are post-World War II institutions not working anymore. That's a great frame. I think that Peter's idea that 2019, if we're defining 2019 as, hey, Sagar, if I order a piece of furniture, it comes in less than a month. It's taken 3 months for my new media console and coffee table to come from Westdale, which is crazy, right? Like in 2019, if someone said in 2019, 3 months to get a media console, someone would say, oh man, that must've been what the 1910s were like. You had to have the Sears Roebuck catalog, right? And then they like sent it by mail. Then you had to go to the general store and you didn't have your Model A Ford yet. So yeah, I get how that would have taken a while. That falls from Peter's book. However, where I think Peter is wrong is, I think Peter is wrong about just like a specific thing. So like on the episode, he specifically said he thinks Chinese civilization is going to collapse. He said they're going to collapse. I'm like, oh, like you mean like the CCP is going to fall? Oh, you mean like the pop? He's like, no, I think Chinese civilization is going to collapse. Like, look, guys, Chinese civilization is 5,000, 6,000 years old. I think that's Peter's like very like smart analysis intersecting with clickbait incentives. I would not make any bets on, you know, Chinese civilization collapsing because of the fact that prices and globalization are going up. Chinese civilization survived the century of humiliation. It survived getting overpassed by Europe, the warring states period. I would really suggest that that isn't going to happen. And then two, I do think he's off on the domestic political analysis in the sense just that I think people who are doomer don't understand incentives and how people who actually engage in politics respond. So a quick example of this, Sagar, a decently prominent podcaster reached out about a question I asked Bology, and I wanted to talk about this for a quick second. And this relates to the Peter point. So during the episode, I think it was, you know, around minute 16, I was like, hey, Balaji, so you're talking about how like, you know, the US and like the West, all these things are basically doomed. But in the late 70s, we left Vietnam, Watergate, stagflation, energy crisis, Arab oil embargo. Things looked terrible, but within 10 years of that, we had the end of history, quote unquote. And, you know, the Reagan revival and Bill Clinton and all those things. What makes you think that you are not simply doing the same thing a doomer in the 1970s would have done? Balaji didn't really answer the question, but I think the point here also applies to Peter, which is it's easy to focus on these very, very straightforward big things, but just undercount how, well, in the 70s, if you have all of these problems, they're going to create space for someone to argue against those problems, to propose different approaches to those problems. Now, people can disagree with like conservative neoliberalism. They could disagree with Margaret Thatcher. They could disagree with Ronald Reagan. But the point is, Reagan, Thatcher, et cetera, actually brought forth a politically popular response to the problems of the 70s and the problems of basically like the New Deal order breaking down, the problem of Vietnam ending in defeat. So what I think is going to happen when Peter says, like, look, you're going to have the world fall apart because America isn't going to want to, let's say, supply the Navy properly, and you're going to have piracy, and you're not going to be able to get any goods and all these different big problems. My response is, okay, if all that starts to happen, I just genuinely believe that funding the Navy seriously will become a political priority. And frankly, if you just look at book publishing, if you look in the marketplace of ideas, that's already out there. Like the number of books about like funding the Navy and the importance of sea lanes, it's actually kind of quick. There's literally been like 6 or 7 books just in the past year when that was not a topic that was engaged with. So like my point there is, you're kind of seeing an example of the fact that, well, if people, if a world without a Navy is a world where we can't get goods and people are starving, well, people are going to say, okay, maybe instead of spending money on X, we start spending money on the Navy again, which is what we did in the 80s. It's what we did in the 1910s. Things can swing and respond in different directions.
My only counter would be that was also at a time when the US just still had unambiguous strengths relative to its peer competitors. And China is actually just 10 times stronger than the Soviet Union. And we actually just don't know what it looks like. Also, we had a shit ton more manufacturing. We had a lot more nimble and capable industry. We had a much higher of a domestic workforce. We didn't live in nearly as globalized as an economy. I mean, for example, with a ship, I mean, you can't even build a ship today without importing, like, I think, I forget the exact numbers. A lot of it cannot even be built without France, Europe. So we're much more reliant on global shipping lanes. Anyway, that would be a decent counter, I think, which is that, yeah, in 1978, guess what, Marshall? We had a ton of domestic manufacturing capability that existed post-World War II. We still had the baby boomers at the prime working age. Like, obviously, fiscally, like, our house was, like, much more in order. That led to the ability for, also, you know, Reagan coming out during the decline of the Soviet Union. There's just no evidence that China is on that trajectory. Now, Peter could be right. It's possible. I'm frankly just don't really believe it, just because I think authoritarianism can mask a lot, as we found out in the Soviet Union. Like, if China is to have its Soviet Union moment, it comes 30 years from now. It doesn't come today. Right now is like the 1960s of the Soviet Union, which was arguably the peak of their power in terms of China. So sure, it could be headed downhill, but that takes a long time. So I've really come to start thinking in terms of like ebbs and flows and like looking at the most basics of what runs economies. That's what I was talking about, energy. I'm like, oh, when energy prices are high, Germany's trade deficit goes negative for the first time in 30 years. Like, that is far more determinative of global events than a lot of the top line stuff that people have been focused on.
Yeah. And I think what I like about your pushback is, rhetorically, I was basically just treating make more ships as this dial you could turn.
Right.
I was basically saying, well, look, the reason why like our Navy is behind China right now is we had defense sequestration back in 2012 and we just decided not to prioritize that in the budget. We were fighting the war on terror, so that wasn't the big priority. And if we could have politicians who would argue that the Navy is important and let's spend more money on it, that could lead to a bigger Navy in the 2030s and protect the sea lanes that Peter is talking about. But I think your point is actually really, really interesting. And actually, I want to, there's actually a book on this. There's a new book that came out about like the building of the latest US supercarrier out in Virginia. And I'm actually going to do a show on that and ask a bunch of the questions you just asked, because that's like really smart. I appreciate that. So yeah, correct. So this is the flaw in what I'm arguing. I'm basically acting. It's if the primary challenge is like money, that one's like pretty straightforward, even under inflation conditions. However, because once again, like Reagan starts his defense buildup as inflation is still high, as they're still recording from the 70s. But your point is actually there's two steps here. It's convince the public to spend money, but then two, money doesn't help if you can't actually physically do things. And then to circle back to what Peter could be right about, there are just all these assumptions that we've formed post-World War II that basically just don't work. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, chips are a good example. People are like, oh, great, we passed the CHIPS Act. I'm like, no, we're starting. It takes 10 years to build a fab. 10 years. It takes five from the in terms of the precise tooling. Now, listen, maybe if you throw everything at it and you make it a national project, you could reduce that to two. But still not so simple. If China takes over Taiwan tomorrow, like the economy literally folds in half for at least a minimum of 2 years, best case scenario. So like that is what I try to emphasize, which is our companies are so globalized, so financialized, and lack so much domestic manufacturing capacity that Fortress America does not exist anymore. And I just think that that's just something we literally just not have grappled with in a really long time. And one day the bill will come to.
Great question. All right, everyone, if you are a subscriber, you're going to continue to get this episode. If you are not a subscriber, go to realignment.supercast.com to get the rest of the conversation. It's really helpful for us, obviously, but it's also just a fun way to support the show.